Hi, this is Nicole Hemsoth, editor of HPC Wire, here with today's edition of Soundbite, our daily interview series featuring researchers, thought leaders, and newsmakers in the world of high-performance computing. Today we'll be talking with Christine Pearson, co-founder of the Materials Project, about how her team is making use of a unique processing approach on supercomputers at NERSC to continuously calculate chemical properties of various materials and make those available to researchers seeking to develop better batteries, solar cells, and other products. Hi, Kristen. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Nicole. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a description of your background and how this led you to develop the Materials Project. And you'll probably have to define what the Materials Project is and what it seeks to do.
Okay. I started out as a material scientist, a computational physicist, actually, in Sweden many years ago. I did my PhD in Stockholm. I'm from Sweden originally. It was in the beginning days, I would say, of applying computers to calculating materials properties from the Schrödinger equation, from first principles, like we call it, with no adjustable parameters. And it was exciting because we could see, even though we were doing very few materials at a time, it took me a whole year to just do tungsten, for example. It was exciting to see that we could actually calculate from quantum mechanics how a material would behave in certain conditions. Then from there on, I went on to do that was very fundamental work. There wasn't a lot of applications to it. But I went on to become a postdoc at MIT in Professor Heerbrand-Sater's group, and that was much more geared towards using these kinds of computations to understand and design materials. They had contracts with industry. And also, he was running a consulting business on the side, and I was very interested in working with that because I liked the idea of doing work, applying my research that it could actually be used in an industrial setting or for people who were trying to design better materials. Mm-hmm. And also, the computational power had gone up significantly during those years. So the kind of computers, the kind of materials we were looking at or computing were now more complicated. We can do more in a few months, and that has kept on accelerating the pace. So this, you know, we're not talking the beginning of the 2000s, and now the computing power was significantly better. And I would say that it was in 2004 something really changed, because we were asked by Duracell, and Procter & Gamble to help them with coming up with or finding out whether there was anything better than manganese dioxide that they use in their AA batteries, the little non-rechargeable batteries that you have in your, in some of your consumer electronics at home. And they were wondering if there's any better material out there. And we thought for the first time that we could use a high-throughput approach to screening materials. We had calculated things like voltage and capacity for materials before, but only one at a time. But Procter & Gamble had this huge computing center somewhere out in the Midwest that they were giving us access to. So by now suddenly sort of serializing our calculations or spinning out tons of them on the supercomputing center, we could screen thousands of materials in months. And that really changed the way we thought about things and how we addressed a research project. Rather than looking very closely at one material, we now use the approach to screen thousands and thousands of materials for the kind of properties we were interested in. And we built the first database. We built the first sort of set of scripts that could handle these kinds of calculations on the Procter & Gamble supercomputer.
Okay. And at that time, you had an unprecedented, for you anyway, number of cores at your disposal.
Yeah, that was like kids in a candy store for computational physicists.
Right. I can only imagine. So this type of application, does it do well on just general CPUs? Does it do well on GPU? Have you experimented with some different processing approaches? And what are some of them?
So this runs well on very simple things. So it's not a traditional sort of like supercomputing problem in the sense that our codes are not particularly well parallelizable. We actually run very well on just, you know, like eight cores or something of a computer with 30 processors or something. And beyond that, we don't really use much more. That's as much as we can parallelize these codes. What we do instead, we spit out many jobs so we can run thousands of materials at the same time.
Okay.
That's,
all right.
So it's sort of the trivial parallelization of it. And these jobs can run for more or less time. Some of them will finish in a few minutes. Some of them will take 4 days, depending
right.
on how the complexity of the material. So we're not one of those supercomputing examples where you throw out one problem over 1,000 processes and it runs in an hour. We're actually the
mm-hmm.
opposite of that. And that's why it's taken us a little longer to be able to utilize the kind of supercomputing resources that we have.
Right.
Are
there efforts underway to make this code more parallelized? Is it even necessary? Is it good just the way it is?
No, I think we would all welcome that. But one of the codes we're using is, you know, it's developed in Vienna and in Europe. So it's not something that is under our control. It's not easy to parallelize these codes. Beyond that, there are other codes that run a little bit better than this on a few more processors. But on the other hand, they have other shortcomings. So
right.
It's not a solved problem. And if it was easy, somebody would have done it.
Right. There you go. So let's talk a little bit about what you've done at the supercomputing centers where you are there at NERSC. What have your experiences been? Can you give us a few examples of how you've used what almost sounds like an opportunistic way of utilizing available cores? Is that a good way to think of it?
Yeah, I would say so. What we had to do in order to use, so the queuing system at most supercomputing centers are a little bit geared against us because they tend to favor jobs that are massively parallelizable. So you can have three jobs in the queue, but each of these jobs will run over 1,000 processors and for 5 hours. That's jobs that are very well situated. We tend to throw out 500 jobs over 32 processors, and we would like them to be able to run for anything between an hour to 5 days. So
okay.
Very different wall times, very different, and then lots of jobs in the queue. And most supercomputing centers don't allow you to have more than like 10 or 20 jobs in the queue. After that, you have to, you know, when they start running, you have to supply more. So NERSC has been very flexible and worked with us first to increase the number of jobs we could submit in the queue, which was, wasn't allowed before. And also, in the beginning, we ran with reservations because our wall times were just longer than it would have taken us so too long to get into to actually run our calculations when we were asking for that long wall time. It's not an easy problem for us to utilize the tremendous computing power that is available. And some computing centers in the world we can't even run there because our codes just won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And the queuing
problem.
Strategy won't allow us to utilize to run the way we have to run.
Have you heard of similar issues at other centers or from other areas where people are doing similar types of research on the application level where this has become a challenge?
Yeah, so I mean, just to give you an example, I mean, most scientists in my field, they buy their own cluster. And that's their main computing source, and it's vastly inefficient, right? You know, from energy perspective as well as manpower, because now their grad students and postdocs are managing a cluster in some room instead of using the facilities that we have around the country. And then they typically have an account on a supercomputing center as well, but that's just to boost their main computing they do on their own clusters. Because
mm-hmm.
of this issue with wall time as well as the number of jobs in the queue, which, you know, we're going against the grain of what exascale computing and the next generation of parallelizable computing is.
Right.
So what we've done is we've done our best to utilize what we can get, and NERSC has been one of those centers where they have worked really, really closely with us and tried to sort of be more flexible in what they allow. But we've written workflow codes that keep track of all these calculations. That manage them, that fixes them when something goes wrong. So there's as much automation as possible in it. And those workflow codes are actually open source and people can contribute to them and hopefully more people will use them.
Might this be a good fit for using, say, Amazon Web Services or even a grid computing model where you can distribute this out? Have you considered that or tried it, or is this code just too specific to...
Well, we've had some conversations with, for example, with Google, because they have a lot of computing that they give out to scientific research, but they have this one CPU hour model where you can get tons of computing But you only get it for 1 hour, and then you have to wipe the memory clean, and that doesn't work for us, right, because of our wall time issues, that we can't, again, spit them out on 1,000 processors and therefore compress the time. So that one doesn't work. I think Amazon works. They will allow you to do longer jobs, but you pay more for it, basically, than we would pay for it if we just bought our own stuff.
Oh, it'd be okay. So it'd be more that way than if you did buy your own cluster.
Yeah, we've looked at it. Sometimes when we sort of estimate how much money our computing. I mean, right now the materials party is running at about 20 million CPU hours per year, and we could definitely use more. But that's about what we're looking at, and that's quite a significant chunk of money at Amazon.
There are widespread programs that are doing everything from crunching genomics info to looking for extraterrestrial life out there that are distributed on computers that are just running. So this runs in the background on the Boeing software. Is this maybe a good fit for that type of model?
I don't think so. Our software or algorithms are not, I would say, as easy. They fail. About 10% of our runs fail. And again, if you use the workflow that we developed, we have little fixes and what we call it a custodian that keeps track of this, you can fix some of these errors, but not all of them. And in the end, it requires somebody with a code-specific knowledge to look at the data and to look at the output to make sure that it ran okay. And we have a number of automated scripts that keeps track of that, but again, if you don't know anything about the code, or it's just not as robust yet. You know,
right.
I remember in the old days when all of our computers were used to look for the next prime number. That's an easy algorithm compared to and that's somebody that it's something that anyone can run, right?
Right?
But ours aren't that robust yet.
Yeah, this is a very interesting problem that you have too, and it seems like there should be some solution beyond buying your own cluster. That leads me to the question, just talking hardware here. So if you had to put together an ideal cluster to solve specific materials science problems, what would it look like? Would it have a great deal of memory? Would it just be focused on as much compute horsepower as you could get? What do you actually need to make this work better?
So most computing, we buy fairly cheap stuff. If I were to buy my own cluster, it's the Beowulf cluster. Very simple in the basement. It doesn't have tons of memory requirements, typically. I think you can get away with 1 gigabyte or something like that per node. It's not particularly, yes, horsepower is important, right? The faster you have, the faster processors you have, the faster your job will typically run. So that compresses that wall time of those long runs, which is important. So I would say less on the memory. We tend to go as cheap as we can so we can get a lot of processors so we can run a lot of jobs. But nothing particularly fancy in terms of and communication between the nodes is also, I would say, not as there are some other codes that require a lot of very fancy communication. I wouldn't say that that's that important either.
Okay. All right. Well, it sounds easy enough to get what you need there.
That's why a lot of material scientists in our field have actually bought their own stuff. And, it's more about just having access and the flexibility of a supercomputing center and if you have your own cluster, you can just let your grad students and postdocs run whatever they want to. And frequently what they do is they just launch 1,000 jobs and then they take off for the weekend.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk just briefly here as a closing segment about what's at stake. What do you think some of the things that you're working on right now can change about the world and the products that we use and the waste that we generate and all of that? What are some of the key things at stake that make this a priority?
So materials are, I'm talking about my own field here, so I'll get very excited. But, materials are unbelievably important. They're all around us. If you think about everything you're using in your daily life that makes your life different than what it was in the Stone Age, there's a reason, by the way, we call it the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, because it really is materials that change the way society works. If you look at the communication age we have today, it's only because, we invented high purity glasses that could transmit signals across long distances without changing the signals. And those are all material science problems and materials that we came up with and designed. And so it's really the sky is the limit. I mean, the kind of we're working on batteries, which one of the topics to come up with better batteries that we can get so we can use our renewable sources in a more efficient way and enable electrified transportation, which would be huge. That would cut our carbon footprint quite a lot. One of the things we're working on is thermoelectrics, coming up with a material that can transform heat into electricity would recover a ton of the waste heat that we produce today in our industry. And we could put it on things like, you know, like trucks that have warm parts to them or wherever we produce waste heat, basically, and turn that into something useful instead of just warming our environment with it.
That's exciting.
And that's just that. Those are real materials problems. It's all about coming up with a material that can do that for and a material that will last in the environment for which it's designed. So there are a lot of different properties and metrics that you have to address. And it can't be too expensive. It can't be made out of gold and platinum because then it just won't work in our commercial world.
Well, it'd be very beautiful to have gold and silver batteries, though, wouldn't it?
It would be nice. So they'd be pretty.
So one final question for you. What's the most exciting material on the horizon right now?
Well, you know, maybe for this audience, one of the more exciting materials that are coming, but we don't really know yet, is something to replace silicon as a transistor. In the transistor chips, we are hitting Moore's law quite significantly, and the only reason we are still getting faster computers is because we're cramming more into a smaller space. It's not the material is actually sort of exactly the same, and there are a couple of new materials on the horizon that we know are much faster than silicon. One of them I believe is coming out of Stanford. I think it's an oxide. And there might be some others too, but I think that would be really cool when we have the, you know, a game change for computing.
Okay, great. We'll keep an eye on that. And Christine, thank you so much for taking time with us today. We'll keep an eye on the materials project and your work at NERSC. We appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Sure thing. Take care.